nuclear abolition, social justice, that sort of thing, because all these things are, of course, connected. So bring us here today to give us a bit of an update, and then we'll have time for questions. He may want to give a little more background on the study group, which, as you can tell, is predominantly study, but also a lot of advocacy. And they've done a lot of work in Washington to inform Congress, other branches of government. They proposed lawsuits and won them to stop certain projects at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. So they've done an enormous amount of work over the years. Greg's background is engineering, so he's got a lot of the technical expertise that probably nobody else has in this field. So we are privileged today to get a chance to see a little window into that. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Donna. Whoa, I'm so sorry. I was going to tape that down, and then I forgot.
Okay, hopefully it won't trip you up.
I am going to tape this talk because we have two young interns working in, two young socialist interns working in the office. And and one of them is in New York with President of Cuba right now, and the other one, I think, is probably rock climbing. Thank you, Donna, very much, and it's an honor to be here talking to this group of people, and which has been individually important for Trish and I, my wife, who's very much part of this, but she's recovering from knee surgery right now and is at home. It's, you know, day 12. And the Mennonite Central Committee was very important for me in my religious formation and my nonviolent formation as a young potential draftee in college. And so I'm thinking to talk for half an hour, and then we'll discuss or answer questions for another half an hour. Is that okay?
Sounds great.
Okay, I'm going to probably go quickly. There will be a lot of words. I have pushed all the neat pictures down to the bottom, so there might not even be any. So that link is not live there. Save as many as you can. That is a popular Hollywood restatement of the Bodhisattva ideal of Mahayana Buddhism. And since this was delivered by a very fine actor, it's a very nice little clip, which you can sometimes find online. The Dmitry Medvedev, he's the bad boy in the Kremlin right now, the bad cop to deliver all the harshest messages. However, they feel over there that we have lost track of reality. And some people say, oh, they're threatening. Well, they are kind of threatening. That's what deterrence is. The terror and deterrence is terror. And if you don't induce terror, you don't have deterrence. Not that we like this, by the way, but that's the theory, as explained by Sandia. And then Simone Weil, perhaps you've seen this from me before. We find ourselves in the study group partly very politically, and we don't map onto the U.S. political spectrum very well at all. We're rather conservative in many ways and rather radical in many ways. Simone Weil was both also. And the situation in France is not that, it's not completely dissimilar, especially as described here to us. And I put a few more quotes here because I couldn't make up my mind as to what would be the most important the global order is in decomposition, which changes everything and changes everything for we, the full-time peace activists. This quote from Joaquin Flores is important and was quite prophetic, given what came later, since 2016, 17, and on down to now. Here in New Mexico, I'm just touching upon these. He spoke of this as a national problem. It's especially a problem here in New Mexico, and we fight it every darn day. We just yesterday afternoon had another fluff piece from a journalist who really does know better about making nuclear weapons and how cool it is. Yeah. And she knows better. But her, as Trish said, her boss called her up and told her that she had to do this. The Associated Press received a grant from the Carnegie Foundation to write stories, including about Los Alamos. We know the people involved, and they are married to our former board president. And it's part of the DC blob, which we hear about all the time. And so it's a small world in DC, and it's a problematic world. So what are we? No one really knows. We are a kind of an analytically based nonprofit. We did more organizing than we have in the past, than we did recently, because it was easier and it paid off better in terms of actual political change. And in 2008, we ran out of money, and we realized that the cheapest thing we could do was to go to Washington and lobby. But by that point, we had built up a lot of relationships and goodwill in Washington, and we were shocked by how welcome we were in congressional committees and in the White House. And so I'm sure I have met, I've conducted more than 500 briefings there since then, and COVID kind of confused all of that. Now and Washington is now a very strange, upside down, inside out place. And we are revitalizing our organizing side a little bit more, in part through the young persons who we are trying to train up. Our current projects are, let's say, these five. We have played a central role in stopping the United States from manufacturing the cores of nuclear weapons in the past, starting in 89 and 90. And we intend to do that again. It's much harder this time because of the political atmosphere and because of the sense of desperation and because of the war fever that has gripped Washington. Nonetheless, we are aided by God-given facts which can't be changed, like seismicity of Los Alamos, its topography, its isolation, and the very poverty and failure to develop in northern New Mexico, which is in part a product of our nuclear colonial status, is now turning around to bite Los Alamos National Laboratory because they cannot find the workers they need. We have to start speaking up more. I personally have a very hard time with this. I find that I never regret making people mad, but I often regret not speaking up. So these are, I will lose sleep over what I should have said, and I never lose sleep over what I have said. And we the study group need to speak up a lot more. We have now a lot of experience. This is full-time experience. And we have been active internationally at the UN and nationally and locally. And we are kind of elder statesmen now. And we are appalled by some directions that are now going on. And we do have people who will listen to us. And so we are not going to get anywhere in nuclear disarmament or arms control until we take Russia's security needs into account, which used to be a given when the study group started. In Washington, in the second Clinton administration, there came to be the habit of pushing Russia around, and that became normalized in people's career identities. And then the neocons that rose to power under George W. Bush just moved sideways and went into the Obama administration, and now they are running everything. We have a Freedom of Information Act program, which is rather lame right now, but the young persons are very interested in this. Our lawyers had the idea that we should file a lawsuit in Washington, D.C., and for long, but the, just to be blunt, the federal courts are corrupt. And the judge we had was appointed to an appellate position, appellate court, and she did not want to do anything against the national security complex while her ratification was pending. Well, starting with the executive summary, sometimes I never get beyond it. So this is it. Nuclear disarmament is off the table. It was happening in the 90s, and now we have convinced a broad part of Russian society that the United States is not agreement capable. And this is also present in China. So it is not centered in Mr. Putin. It is broad-based. Another thing which is really important is that our democracy has more or less collapsed. And not locally, let's say, but nationally. And double government is a British idea from the 19th century. The founder of The Economist magazine invented this term, but it refers to a government that has a front face that the population sees and which kind of placates people, and then the actual mechanisms of how things work and are administered are done by a permanent bureaucracy, a permanent civil service. So, and in our case, all the people who are rotating in and out of government. Ray McGovern, ex-CIA, senior person, was here on this exact spot describing this a few years ago. And he calls it the Mickey Matt, the military, industrial, congressional intelligence, media, academic think tank complex. And the M is emphasized in the middle because the media is the key element in it, which leads us to the next bullet, which is somewhat new. New since, let's say, 2014, when the saturation of propaganda in the society becomes so complete that then people lose any way to compare things. And so we now think, we interact with a lot of people, and it's amazing what people say, what people think, and how violently they think it. So it has become almost an absolute value to speak up now, because we are in the grips of various mass delusions. And the mass quality of this is quite dangerous. It is it's the precondition or the manifestation of totalitarianism. So it's not like a classic dictatorship where there's somebody or a small elite in charge. Now we have what Hannah Arendt called a diabolical pact between a ruling elite and a significant fraction of the population who are manipulated and who are fully bought into what this elite wants. The preconditions for this will be of tremendous interest to the church because they involve alienation, free-floating anxiety, atomization of society. All of these things make a society susceptible to propaganda, which has been increased in its effectiveness, its techniques, and it comes now from a lot of sources. So it's very difficult to get a word in edgewise. And we have also what we see as the intentional division of society into warring factions, which prevent, so for just to take an example, I attended an anti-war rally in Washington, D.C., because I happened to be there anyway in February, and it was a left-right rally, and it was very difficult for the organizers of the rally to put this together, to keep it together, and so right now the anti-war forces in society are basically the far-right Republicans in the House, primarily, and one or two in the Senate. And I think it's very important for the gigantic military, industrial, and Mickey men to keep those people from making common cause with progressives in society. And as long as that latter group can be kept happy with issues which do not affect the structure or the income of the war state, then that can just go on. Another aspect of this, which I wanted to bring forth here, is that contrary to our usual assumptions, we're now in a state of decline. I had decline and fall in the title of this talk, but I took that out. Thinking that people would get too depressed or it wouldn't be credible. But we have enormous problems. We have kicked too many cans down the road. And as you know from your own work in the community, the hammer falls on the vulnerable to a tremendous extent, both here in our society and worldwide. And so the work of justice, economic justice, and providing for the vulnerable remains central in our conception of the good life here at the study group, for certainly. I just should say, returning to Simone Weil, the concept, and perhaps this is of use here, the concept of human rights, which we base most of our law on. Simone Weil says, well, that was one of the mistakes of the men of 1789. It's not strong enough. So she and Gandhi and other people emphasized the preeminence of responsibilities, which I think is much more of a biblical idea than human rights, which was a reactive idea to kingship as it was exercised. Just an aside. The looming defeat in Ukraine, to the extent it's not already patent, is really a multi-sided disaster for conventional U.S. foreign policy. And it is related to these other things which we in the liberal press hardly know about. There is a potential for near-term havoc, for example, most of the people, my wife, myself, most of the people around us don't think that we will have any kind of ordinary presidential election next year. Not a fair one, not what we would have considered an election in the past. And of course you can see the signs of that already. The Robert Kennedy Jr. is not allowed to debate and is denied Secret Service protection. It's really weird, but more weird stuff is surely coming. The problems are worldwide and severe. Crises in food, water, weather, governance, and war. This has a lot of implications. We don't pretend to have answers to them all, but I'm just laying it all out here. Because this leads to contradictions in the study group. In October, I'm going to Washington again and to try to talk to sane people, and which there are quite a few of. And at the same time, the power that is wielded by the nuclear contractors, the military contractors, and their captive funders is tremendous. Privately, senior managers at the GAO, one who was a former government professor, said many of us don't know whether the United States will, as we know it, will exist in a few years. So he's a very, extremely sober individual, producing reports for Congress with a long background in government. We believe that these crises, we see these crises affecting the nuclear establishment acutely. So they are having a heck of a time accomplishing their work. And we, of course, like that. You might see this week an article which will be forthcoming. Whistleblower or Refusnik contacted us from Los Alamos. He refuses to work in the plutonium facility. His mother died of occupational illness. The lab, or rather, federal government paid the family death duties, such as they are. And he's an ex-Marine, 22-year journeyman electrician, but he won't work in the plutonium facility for moral as well as safety reasons. There's others as well. We have spent way too many hours with a Los Alamos businessman, a contractor who has seen light in his 50s. And he's just full of questions. And he also is full of information, since he knows everybody in town and has all these contacts in the lab. And So 8 electricians were just contaminated with beryllium. And because the lab sent them to work in a contaminated area without any personal protective equipment. And that's because the people in charge are young, inexperienced, and in a rush to get stuff done. And that'll also come out this week. But in what form it will come out? So the bottom line is that we are in an emergency situation in our society, and we need to talk about these things in our families, and we're not going to be able to solve all the problems. There are predicaments, not really solvable problems, but we have to figure out what we stand for and where we stand and how we're going to manage. As a community and as individuals, I should say that my stepsons assemble nuclear weapons for a living, and so does one of the wives. She is a supervisor. She works right now graveyard shift at the Pantex nuclear plant. They don't like it. They got in, sucked in. They came to their mother in tears, saying, "Going to take this job. I, you know, it's pays three times as much, and I'll have health insurance, I'll be able to have a family. She said, you won't be able to get out once you get in. That's a problem. Well, that has proven to be the case. So it is difficult to get out once you are used to the six-figure salary. So Los Alamos is paying high school graduates with no skills $70,000 to become plutonium operators with a ton of benefits. The annual salaries in the plutonium facility, Trish just got a document from her recovery bed last night, up to $391,000 a year in the plutonium facility. Their plans to make more atomic bombs are currently held up by lack of electricians and innumerable other factors. They're at least 4 years, if not 6 years, delayed, and costs have multiplied by multiples. That we'll come to that briefly. This production mission is not needed for the existing stockpile, but it is enabled. It is important for the U.S. military establishment self-image, and it doesn't add a lot. Or it keeps Livermore Lab with a new design mission. It grows Los Alamos Lab by thousands of employees. They're shooting now, they're approaching 20,000 employees. And this mission will add, starting up production at Los Alamos is like building a whole other laboratory. And between now and about 2033, 34, when things really get going, assuming that they could actually do this, it will be a $20 billion investment. And so we're still in the early phases. It's multiples more money than has ever been spent in New Mexico on any other capital project, except all of the interstate highways put together. It is an absurd mission. It lacks any engineering basis. No reports support it. And because of this, Santa Fe and northern New Mexico are ideally suited to block it. And Los Alamos has failed at this mission four times before. And we intend to help them fail again. But we have to fight against the Democrats in this state and nationally. And let's see, this also artificially increases spending all over the country. And it's not needed. It could be postponed. There are senior people who understand this, including in the military. We are concerned that if we are unable to break the stride of the empire and the war state, that we will not even begin to properly address the social and environmental problems we face, which are overwhelming. We think that eventually all of these problems will catch up with this industry and that it will fail. And however, we don't want it to fail taking us all down with it. We want to find a way to assert humane values in the policy context right now. I have about 2 minutes. This was legislative testimony from last month. This pit production mission is only in Los Alamos because of the perception that the New Mexico government and society is weak and cannot oppose it. This is what the laboratory told us in 1992. That man is actually giving a talk in Los Alamos this week. He's retired. He's in his 90s. Legislature is New Mexico This is just a deconstruction of the typical economic development narrative, which is used to drive this, but it's really more of an excuse. Really, what is happening is our political leaders are just caving, and they're looking for some ex post facto excuse for just going along. The ringleader of all this currently is Senator Heinrich. Senator Domenici, as well as Senator Bingaman, opposed this mission for Lanham.
A couple pictures quickly. So we're talking about making that.
Each one of these things will cost $100 million by the time Los Alamos is done. They're made of plutonium. They're hard to make. This is all set up so that Los Alamos can make one about every 2 weeks. They're not complicated, but they're precise and they're very dangerous. So the pit is inside the primary. And what is it for? You don't need this. This is just take impressionistic glance at this. There's a cascade of work for the 70 or 80,000 people who make warheads in the United States. So it's planned out here all the way to more or less out to 2045, nuclear weapons forever. So the Los Alamos pits are for a particular warhead that goes on ICBMs, which are in silos. So that's an old picture of that warhead when it was brand new. It's still modern in most respects. It's very accurate. It's getting more accurate starting next year because it's going to get a new fuse gumi, which is smarter. It's smart, like a smartphone as opposed to a regular old analog phone. And so it can explode in just the right place. Anyway, that's the missile. All of the U.S. ICBMs are being replaced, are to be replaced. The initial investment is somewhere between roughly 100 billion. It could be as much as 150 billion. The figures are actually classified. The life cycle cost of the system is about $250 billion. So it's a matter of upgrading all of the old silos, the communication systems, and replacing the missiles, and the software and all that. But there are enough of those other warheads to put on every missile, but just not three at once like that. So that's the goal, to be able to put three on there, which we don't have now, and we can't do because it would violate the New START treaty with Russia. But that's supposed to expire in 2026. Anyway, I think that's the... Oh, yeah, well, that is a protest at the Rocky Flats plant. That was the last pit factory that the United States operated. And it's been 34 years since the United States has been able to make an entirely new atomic bomb with new pits. And our goal is to extend that. We don't think that we can have a national movement right now for a number of reasons, including or especially the various crises that the country faces, which affect people so directly in their households and in their families. That's it. Questions and comments? Yes, George.
Does the United States have a nuclear use policy written down someplace?
Yes. It's that just that there isn't a policy.
What?
There is. It's written down, but it basically boils down to what the president wants to do.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a old Latin Roman saying, Inter armis legis silence. In war, the law is silent. Yes?
Well, this is incredibly informative and overwhelming. I'm not even sure what questions to ask, but one thing I wondered about when you said that there's been a failure multiple times before to achieve the goals mm-hmm. set out. Mm-hmm. So those were specific goals marked by, we want to accomplish this by a certain date, mm-hmm. and we're now at the point of failing.
Yes.
In a good way.
Yes.
For fourth time or so.
Yes.
How does that affect decision making in Washington? Multiple failures. How's that interpreted? How's that responded to?
That's a really good question. Congressman Garamendi from California emphasized this history in a thank you letter he wrote when we talked to him for an hour in June, and he didn't know it. So I would say almost no one knows it. Really no one. People who were full-time professional people involved in the field don't know it. Don't know that Los Alamos has failed at this. So the failures look like this. In 1988, the Reagan administration understood that they were going to lose the Rocky Flats plant, that it was getting too contaminated, and they had built a new building to take up some of the slack, but it took a really long time, and because of the oil crisis in the 1970s and changing contractors and design changes and so forth, that building failed. And then building 776 or something like that. And the building had to be shut down for most purposes just a month after it was made. And from that point on, the people running the nuclear weapons establishment said, we need a new factory, a whole new factory. And we have opposition from the governor of Colorado, and this is becoming unviable. So Los Alamos, which was run by a plutonium scientist, said, hey, let's build a big new plutonium building, a kind of multi-purpose omni-plutonium building. And in a way, that was our first project. I was volunteering for another organization. I talked them into working on this with me. And there was a big public outcry because Rocky Flats was so much in people's minds. And Senator Bingaman killed it. I pushed that piece of paper across the table to him with four existing plutonium facilities and asked him, why are we building a fifth? And he said, gee, that's a really good question. Well, that was then. But they tried to, we had to sue them in 2010 over another version of the same, it was actually almost the same type of facility in exactly the same place. And it was a long, drawn-out battle, and some of the people here were involved in that. But in the end, we convinced the military that it was stupid, and the Obama administration, parts of it. And so that's what the failure looks like. They can't make pits without facilities, and they don't have the right facilities. So it's basically boiled down to preventing them from getting the right facilities. They are investing in two pit factories, one here on a crash basis, one in South Carolina, bigger, on a slower basis, that would start operation in the late 2030s. Our view about this is that we must stop this here and now. And that the late 2030s, for a number of reasons, to quote a government analyst, it's a mirage. And that's, we don't know whether it's a mirage or not, but they're not going to stop that because pretty much everybody in Washington knows that Los Alamos is a very problematic place where problematic things happen. And they will not put, they never use this figure of speech, it's really funny. They stop themselves, but they never put all their eggs in one basket. Yes. Sorry, I talked too long.
You mostly have me pretty confused. I mean, the one takeaway I hear, what I can do, I'm here to figure out. I hate war. I grew up during,
right.
You know, worried about being in a bomb shelter and not having.
Right.
Anyway, so I want to protest war. I've been to Mennonite organizations talking about not paying war taxes, doing an alternative, saying no to this complex that
right.
You're describing, I think, as a second government. But the main thing I'm hearing you say we need to do is call our families together and make them quit their jobs, or tell my kids to quit their jobs and do what? Go into a bomb shelter somewhere?
Right.
What is this disaster? Right. You sound like you're getting really involved in politics.
Yes.
Protesting. But then there was a statement in there that sounded like it said that's useless.
No.
And
no. That's a good question. But yeah. So, we're having a meeting on Wednesday evening in Santa Fe to talk about this stuff again. But how people respond to this is extremely individual, and it's extremely unique to specific families. So if I had, let's say, a special needs child that had a lot of expenses, medical problems, let's say, and I worked at the lab, I think I'd probably keep working there. And that would be a decision that I would have to make individually. It's not public policy, it'd be something that I, you know. So I'm not gonna, once I was leafleting at the plutonium facility and people, you know, you get all kinds of different reactions. You can't do that anymore, but I did once. The only honest person who said anything to me was a Hispanic man and said, we've been poor for generations in my family. I want my daughter to be able to go to college. That's why I'm here. Well, dang it, that was an honest answer. And so there are many things that one can do. In fact, the darker things get, the more things one can do that make a difference. So that's cool. Yard signs, protest at our offices, letters to the editor, op-eds, organizing little groups to do whatever the little group wants to do. Self-education. We posted this morning rather somewhat extensive comments on our Ukraine page, which we update every day, in response to someone's article about why are our leaders so incompetent. Well, that's a big topic, and it would lead to an adult study session. And I find that most people think that if you have a $20 billion program involving 4,000 full-time employees, people think, oh, there's a plan. There must be a plan. Smart people have put forward a plan even if we don't agree with it. But I think it's very shocking for people to know there is no plan. There is not a schedule with money attached to it that goes beyond next year. And the GAO has published a big report about no plan. Congress has asked for a plan for 2 years. No plan has appeared. That's why, as you'll read, I hope, this week, Los Alamos, in addition to not finding enough people, has tons of people sitting around playing cards at $100 an hour because it's all so uncoordinated, but they don't care. So, We are going to introduce a resolution in Santa Fe and the government to update prior resolutions against this. So it's happening also in Taos. We need people to reach out to employees and potential employees. We are reaching out to other organizations, and not just about this particular narrow stovepipe, but also what is happening in Congress is that the Ukraine war is being used as a whip or a goad to make it politically incorrect to the point of political suicide for anyone to vote against building more atomic bombs, more nuclear weapons at this point in time. So the administrator of the NNSA refers to it casually at the beginning of her speeches. But the signal is clear. Vote against, the United States does not have a pit factory. North Korea does, France, Germany, Russia, China. We don't. We're the only one. And so when the military comes in with their uniforms and they sit down with the pressure on Congress people is enormous. And the Ukraine war is a big part of that. Yes. The reason some of these things are suggested is because they're very labor intensive. Whenever you, let's say, call up Sierra Club, this is a personal now relationship, a two-way street, and if we want them to do something, we've got to be responsive to them. And so we're teeny. And we call it the swamp. And we can't step very far into the swamp. That has to be done by volunteers. Well, we are volunteers now, we have to prioritize between going to congressional committees or going to GAO or OMB, where we have ability to meet, or talking to someone here in New Mexico who is so frightened that they hardly know. I mean, they're like, oh, I don't know if I can go against the lab. My girlfriend's ex-boyfriend is, oh my God. Sorry. Yes, I'm sure there is. No one knows really what will happen. Ukraine has lost the war, and unlike, it's difficult to read this in the Western media, but the narratives began to change dramatically about a week ago. And it's now become permissible to start the process, this is my opinion now, of throwing Zelensky under the bus. So he was not allowed to speak in the House. He's getting a trickle of ATACMS missiles. But the signs are there that he must go soon. I don't know how this will end. There's a really great danger that Ukraine using U.S. intelligence targeting NATO weapons will be able to strike some kind of blow that will inflame the Russian public and the Duma, and in which case things could spiral out of control very quickly. But Ukraine is basically bled white. They don't have enough people. They're not going to get enough people. They can't run their economy. The amputation level is approaching World War I scale. And it's a broken country. The war only goes on as long as we provide the money for it and the arms. So if there's a sufficient rebellion in Europe, Or if there is a sufficient pushback here for whatever reason, then Ukraine will have to sue for peace. And we then need to look at, you know, peace in Europe is indivisible. So we need to look at the one party that we haven't really tried to make secure is Russia. The goal was to break up Russia, and on the way to China. And unless, until we change that whole attitude that, which has been a cornerstone of US policy now for a long time, that we mustn't let any power arise in the world which could threaten the United States on an equal basis. Unless we can get over that and become a nation like other nations, then we'll just create, we will, I mean, that's how it would truly end. Yes.
I just want to clarify what you said. So you're saying that Russia should be allowed to take land of Ukraine?
Well, they have. So I think we need to look at this from a realist perspective. They have taken the land. They will not give it up. The people in those areas wanted to be part of Russia and voted to do that, which is a process and a right enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations. And we felt it was very important in Yugoslavia and Kosovo. And we kind of hold our nose as far as Scotland goes, and Wales, and Catalonia, but in Ukraine it wasn't allowed. And so but Russia is not going to give up that territory. The only danger here is that they may feel the need to push the frontier back farther away from their from the Crimea and from the centers of population in the Donbass, as well as from Russia itself. That's the danger.
So you don't see that the people who are in some of those regions that you're calling Russians now, that they were put there fairly recently?
No, they weren't. They voted for the pro-Russian. Those regions voted predominantly for the pro-Russian candidates for president by a large fraction, and they voted. Russia wouldn't accept the first two breakaway provinces in 2014. They begged to be absorbed into Russia, but Russia said no. But some say that if Russia had done that, then none of this would have happened. But the point now, I think, is to stop the bloodshed and to be able to have viable economies and a good life for people, and stop killing Ukrainian men and now also women at a rate of 500 a day, roughly.
And your idea about Belarus, I know you've had a lot of connection there through the years. How do you see?
No, we haven't. Did you say we have had?
Well,
no.
I thought in terms of visiting.
No. No, Trish has been to Kiev.
Yeah. Okay.
And. But no, I.
After the
Chernobyl.
Yeah.
Chernobyl's just south of the border in Ukraine. So she, yeah.
But,
okay. So neither of us ever been to Belarus.
Oh.
My goddaughter is from Belarus, but.
That's
yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Forgive me if you've addressed this already, because I did come in late. But something you were answering to Jeannie and I thought I heard you say that because the two provinces, the Donbas and Ukraine, had voted to basically secede, that under UN they were right to, they had a right to do that. Does that mean in the United States, if North and South Dakota and Minnesota decided to secede and become part of Canada, that we should let them?
So we shouldn't necessarily let them. Now, George Kennan, the you know, the great diplomat architect of Cold War containment, he thought the United States should be broken up, and in his later life. And so it might be a good idea, but the UN Charter, and the UN Charter would not oppose it. The Constitution opposes it, so we'd have to work it out here. So.
And is that situation so different from what happened in Ukraine? I mean, I can see from Ukraine's government's point of view that that was...
Yes, I think that other factors come into play. There were overtly genocidal policies enacted by the Kiev government. And that was the, and there was mass murders, and these were the factors that led to that vote. So the Genocide Convention comes into play, and it's a, so some, you know, you can see it on YouTube, whatever, President Poroshenko saying, and he's running for office, saying, our children will be going to school and learning and advancing. Their children over there in the Donbass are going to be cowering in basements in fear. That's how they're going to live over there, because we're going to keep bombing them. And then there's other factors which have to do with the U.S. maintained a oppositional force in Ukraine after World War II. And the Nazis, basically. And the OUN party and Stepan Bandera and all that. We sheltered these people over there and over here. And we used that extreme nationalism to overthrow the government in 2014. So I would say that since 2014, there hasn't really been a sovereign government in, a legitimate sovereign government in Ukraine. And so there's just an overwhelming, and ratified by Western media before, you know, up to 2021, overwhelming presence of neo-Nazis in the Kiev government. And they're disproportionately powerful because they can so easily, they do so easily resort to violence. So, for example, there was a peace negotiation in, what was it, March or April of 22, the United States and the UK told Ukraine that they must not negotiate an end to this battle. And Boris Johnson went over there. at one point, Putin, not a couple months ago, lifted up, here was the draft agreement. You know, we were actually fairly far along. And military analysts point out that Russia didn't have enough troops to take Ukraine by force, not by a long, long shot. So the, which is why they never called it a war. But setting that aside, one of the negotiators from Ukraine, which had been peace-oriented, was shot on the street by the, and as a warning, by these neo-Nazi formations. Mayors of towns were executed and hung from lampposts. People who wanted peace in Ukraine, you know, wrapped their pants, pulled down, and wrapped them to a light pole with clear packing tape so people could ridicule them. A lot of this has gone on. So, as you know, other political parties are outlawed. Elections are were canceled. Now maybe they're back on. Maybe religious leaders arrested. So, there were reasons why they voted that way. But the biggest reason, I'm bearing the lead, bad journalist, was the massacre of people in Odessa at the trade union building, where protesters were burned alive in the building. Yes.
Do you think there's any chance in Washington right now concerning nuclear reduction theory treaties and they've been getting canceled right and left? I don't know why they're canceling now, other than the Go building.
Yeah.
But is there any movement to try to restore?
No, none at all. Yeah. In fact, this factory is to set the stage for more. But I should say that this is it's a kind of whistling in the dark thing, because the United States cannot possibly match the nuclear production capacity of Russia and China together. So it's kind of, I mean, not that, you know, more warheads would make any difference whatsoever, but we can't be in an arms race. All we can do is stimulate one elsewhere. Los Alamos cannot find enough electricians to install a fire alarm system in the plutonium facility, and they've been working on it for 3 years, and they've got another 3 years to go. So there's no fire alarm system there which meets commercial standards, and they can't find electricians to work on it.
Wow, many complexities. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
For entertaining our questions and for all your research, your advocacy.
Thank you. And it's the churches are beyond important in all this, as we could have talked about in more detail, but you will figure. I mean, you, I'm sure, have been discussing all of this.
As the secular part of our society, 99.99% of it, has lost its way so badly, and people of faith, it's our outreach.